Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris FX and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 9 of season 10. I've been using Boris FX products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today, on Art of the Cut, we're talking with two of the three editors of Matthew Vaughn's comedy action film, Argyle. Joining us for today's discussion are Tom Harrison Reed and Oscar-winning editor Lee Smith, ACE. Lee's been on Art of the Cut several times, including for Dunkirk, 1917, Dark Phoenix, and Spectre. Lee was nominated for a BAFTA for The Piano, for an Oscar and an Ace Eddie for Master and Commander, nominated for an Oscar, a BAFTA, and an Ace Eddie for The Dark Knight, nominated for a BAFTA and an Ace Eddie for Inception, and he was nominated for a BAFTA and won an Oscar and an Ace Eddie for Dunkirk. Tom has edited Tomb Raider, In Darkness, and Children of the Corn. He's also been an assistant editor or additional editor on lots of major tentpole films, including Wonder Woman 1984, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, Captain Phillips, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, and Quantum of Solace. Before I hop into our discussion with Lee and Tom, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free, no-limits, 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Oscar-winning editor Lee Smith, ACE, and Tom Harrison Reed discuss editing Argyle. There's three editors on this film, and we've got two on the call. Tom, can you tell me a little bit about the third editor?
Yes, that's Colin Gowdy, or Cole Gowdy. He was editing the film Tetris that Matthew was producing. When that finished, Matthew invited him into kind of as a consultant on this film to bounce ideas off and try things. He was super helpful. I'd worked with him before on Star Wars Rogue One, and he was a friend of mine. So that was all really harmonious and great. And then when this movie was finishing, and I was going on to another film, but then the visual effects unfortunately meant it couldn't finish, and we had to just keep waiting for them. Colin kindly said he would sort of sit in until the visual effects are done. And then unfortunately that went from 5 weeks to 5 months, and he stayed on longer than he'd signed up for. And in that time, other things happened, and Matthew has other ideas, and so a few changes were made after that point, which, you know, and I was very grateful that he could take all that on. It had three editors who could all do a tour of duty on it.
Director Matthew Vaughn is certainly somebody who knows his way around an action film, and both of you have previously worked with him, correct?
No, I hadn't. Lee had.
Yeah, I did X-Men First Class with Eddie Hamilton, and that was my first outing with Matthew, and this was the second.
Very nice. And what is his collaboration style, or how do you collaborate with him in the editing room any different than anybody else?
Well, this was an interesting project because we were in COVID while it was being shot. I was in Santa Barbara editing. My assistant, Pierce Roma, was in Montana. Tom was following the shoot in a set in around England, and his crew, well, our crew, the rest of them were all in, based either in offices near where Tom was. And then eventually I ended up in London, but only for a couple of weeks before I went on to another film. But by then we'd achieved a first cut of the movie. And then I handed it off to Tom, and then Tom took it over, and the post was incredibly protracted and long because of visual effects. So there was a little bit of interchanging of personnel coming and going to get it to the end, because we were all off doing different films.
Lee managed to do a whole other film and then come back on to Argyle for another few weeks just on his way back.
So, Tom, it sounds like you did a lot of the collaboration post the first cut with him. What kind of collaboration did you do? Like, how does he like to interact with you? Is he a notes kind of guy, or is he a sit behind you and work alongside?
In this film, because we sort of started off working a lot on Evercast, working remotely, we all had sync boxes, we're all spread out. Matthew, particularly because of in the COVID times, he wasn't always keen to come into cutting rooms anyway. So he would usually spend some intensive 3 or 4 hours working remotely on Evercast, or I'd go to his house, or occasionally he'd come into the cutting room and blast through stuff and make notes, try things. And then it would usually end in a, okay, all right, you get all of that done and I'll see it tomorrow. He's not a director who sits in and fiddles with frames at all. If he's got a big idea, he wants to see it fully evolved. So you could talk about it, you could try and talk about it and say, well, if we do this, this has a knock-on effect for this. And he will stop you saying, look, we're going to waste time talking about it. I just want to see it. And I want to be happy to spend 2 weeks on doing an idea that he's not even sure himself is worth trying, just to prove it to himself. He gets very intense about and excited about his own work and his own ideas. And he just wants to do a one-on-one, let's try this. Until it gets to the point where you go, okay, now you finesse it. And then he'll sort of go away and like want to see it the next day.
Lee, I'm really intrigued with the idea that Tom just mentioned, which is somebody willing to do 2 weeks of work on something that's not going to prove fruitful to prove it to themselves. Can you talk a little bit about the value of working on a scene or working on an idea that doesn't end up in the movie?
I think that's the job of being an editor. It's experimentation. And if you've got the joy of having enough personnel and enough time, then crazy ideas can get an outing. And I think, you know, when I was an up-and-coming editor, I used to be basically given all the crazy ideas with the idea that the odds of them working were slim. And I've kind of did that a lot. And I don't do that so much anymore, but it is one of the joys of working on a film with a reasonably large crew. Obviously, on a lower budget film with one editor, you've only got so much time to do what you can do. Because these are such wild and crazy ideas, sometimes, yeah, they take weeks to flush them out. And then perhaps you're on a hiding to nothing. And Tom's got a great personality where he can do that. And if it doesn't go the right way, you know, he doesn't throw himself out the second floor window. So that's handy too.
The way I'd quantify this film is the first assembly that we showed Matthew, he was delighted with it. He actually said, I'm not used to this. I haven't really got any initial notes because it all works. There's some crazy stuff in this film, and he knew he was sort of pushing the envelope a bit. And he was just so delighted that his idea had come to fruition, how he imagined it. So we were starting from this point where he was very pleased with the movie. He liked the first assembly. He obviously, you'd have to compress stuff and tighten it up. So a lot of these ideas he was having was because he was happy and he had his feet on solid ground. And he just wanted to try and kind of rearrange stuff and see if it was fun. And it wasn't kind of ever at a point where we have to fix this. None of this is working. We've got to put out this fire. We've got to shave off these sharp edges that are poking me in the eye. We never had that point where you get to with, well, I certainly have with director's cuts, where there's bits that work and there's bits that the director isn't happy with. And you have to make those bits more the film that they were imagining. We started off from the point where he said, this all works. And this is basically the movie that I had in my head. So we had the luxury of being able to experiment early on, and because of the long visual effects process, I think he just thought he had time to play and try out things, which sometimes I would say, wouldn't that do this and this and this? And he was like, I don't care. Theoretically, yes, but I still think there's some reason to try it. And almost invariably, there was something come out of it, out of the experiment.
There's a lot of comedy in this film and a lot of action, both. Talk to me a little bit about, do you approach those two types of scenes the same? Or, you know, there's also, of course, action built into some of the comedy. Does the comedy take a different mindset to work on, or is it all just editing?
For me, it's just editing. I enjoy a laugh like everyone else, and I enjoy good action. I have talked to a lot of comedy editors who are very specifically comedy editors, and they have some very specific rules that they apply to comedy editing. It's interesting because I've never thought in such a specific sense. It's like, for me, humor's humor. I can tell what's funny and what's not, and I can tell good action from bad. The film was shot with the intent to be humorous, you know, enjoy the ride, don't take it seriously. Every possible moment that could be funny, let's put it in the film. It's like where the train fight when Aiden was being held out the window, or he just before he throws a guy out the window, I laughed a lot because he just said, you know, that beard's real, you dick, as the guy goes out. And it was, and he literally pulled his face and I guess the glue stuck. But it was hilarious. And things like that are comedy gold. We call it the laugh bank. If there's anything funny, audiences love to laugh. But having said that, I don't work in comedies normally. So, and I'm, you know, a funny guy, right, Tom?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a thing with Australians that I think they have the same sense of humour as Brits. So I always go straight into the taking the piss kind of sarcastic sense of humour. With quite a few of them have said, what's your problem? Why are you doing that to me? But Lee's not one of them. He's a very droll character. We have a similar sense of humour. But I agree with Lee completely as well. I don't think that there's a different hat or head that you screw on for action editing. Or comedy editing. Both of them are rhythm and timing in my mind, and taste, really. If you trust your own taste of something that you think feels good for action or it makes you laugh for comedy, you know how long to hold it before the eyebrow gets raised or before the retort comes back. I just think it's something that comes naturally in the judgment that you have to have if you're an editor, and the confidence you have to have in feeling if something's working or not. It's almost exactly the same thing. It's a rhythm thing. It's a timing thing.
What about action scenes and how they're organized? Do you feel like you have to organize them different because, I don't know, they're chopped up with, you know, stunt people and specific punches and that kind of thing? Do you organize an action scene differently than a dialogue scene?
Well, on this movie, we were lucky in a sense. We had a specific approach that there were stunt viz made for every single action scene in this, or all the set pieces. And a lot of them were designed by Brad Allen before he tragically died in prep for this film. So people were very keen to kind of honor his choreography, and it was shot very much in line with the stunt viz. In a way, it had its own way of organizing itself in that regard, that you kind of, we could refer to, oh, this is that particular shot where you reverse back through the guy's legs and this thing happens that was in the stunt viz. So it made it kind of quite easy to put the initial build together because you had something to reference. Lee and I approached this actually differently because I was in a trailer in the unit base on set. I tended to assemble the cut of the action using the template of the stunt viz because I knew that the second unit director was going to come in and want to have a look at it and that everybody was going to refer to it. And Lee, on some sequences, preferred to not reference the stunt viz at all and just judge the dailies as dailies, which was a great luxury that we could do that, because obviously new things are found, like, you know, improvements are there. Things that when Matthew came in to watch it, he was like, oh, I hadn't thought to do that. And that's because Lee had done something completely different at that point. And some things he was like beholden to, and other things he was like, well, no, that's much better. I'd never really had a film that had so much wall-to-wall stunt bit. Everything was planned out, with cardboard boxes and stunt guys and quite elaborate stunt biz with visual effects and temp, you know, After Effects stuff done to them. So we had that template if we wanted to use it.
I mean, I literally don't refer to stunt biz at all. I look at it maybe once, but to me, I knew Tom was there and I knew that the second unit director was there and I knew that they were covering it. So there was a way out of whatever that they were doing. But I preferred the more freeform thing of just cutting it from what I was seeing, coming from a world where we used to do action films with no stunt viz. And sometimes I think obliging yourself to stunt viz gets you all tied up in knots and you don't get the best out of the material. But if you can be doing it simultaneously both ways, then you get the best out of everything, because there were things that were very awkward and then Tom would look at the stunt viz and then we'd realize that they didn't, you know, he'd have to coordinate with the stunt guy because they changed something and, you know, the actors either couldn't quite do it, you know, which is invariable, is when you put the actors in, they're not exactly fluid enough to do what the stunt viz is calling for. So then you've got to cut around that. You've got to use other angles or think it through. But yeah, I mean, the action was cool. It was a lot of fun to cut those action sequences. And the ones that were in camera were the most fun for me. The ones that, you know, had a lot of visual CG work that had to go in were probably the harder ones. The smoke one was, Tom did a lot of work on that. That one had to be kind of followed because it was a dance routine, and also because of the amount of smoke, that was a very tricky thing to use with visual effects. And I remember when I went off and after the assembly came back after doing Empire of Light, I think Tom had finally received, I think, one of the smoke shots. And it was very gratifying because I went, fuck, this could work. If you want to do a trippy hallucinogenic smoke scene, these are the people to do it.
Lee, you've got several credits earlier in your career as a sound designer. Talk to me about the importance of sound design and how much of that you still do to kind of sell these action sequences.
Well, I always love to cut with as much sound work as I can possibly get in, using Pierce Roma, who's been with me for a few years now.
Pierce is your assistant or a sound designer?
He's my assistant, because we don't really have any sound design. I think we did get some stuff from the sound designers while we were shooting. We started building libraries, but like, if a cut's going to have music, you want to be playing music. And this film was obviously going to be driven, these sequences, with music. So, you know, getting appropriate temp in there right from early. I think that's why Matthew was so happy with the assembly, because it played like a movie. I mean, obviously there's scenes like the ice skating where, you know, you have to do a lot of imagining, but you could follow it. You could follow every moment in the film. And as he said to Tom and I, he said he hasn't had that experience for a while where he's not sitting there wondering how this is ever going to make sense. But then the long haul was now the reality of importing in all of these visual effects. And it was just proved to be an incredibly time-consuming process. So we're always trying to make things work with sound, even as rudimentary as you can do in an Avid, and taking a lot of time to fill stuff out and making it work. And Tom's equally interested, invested, and good at it. And we all are. So I just think it's the only way that you know the rhythms of working is you've got to put the sound in. I worked on a particularly bad movie that'll remain nameless as a really early in my career. And the editor had given me this sequence that had someone being pursued by a guy with a rifle and he's shooting. But every shot and ricochet, even though it was the same distance, was different in time. So it'd be like bang, pew, bang, pew, bang. And I had to go back to the picture editor and explain that this is just not making any sense to me, which is tricky when you're 19 and you're telling someone who's been editing their whole life that. And I remember his response was, well, fucking cut it yourself then. And I did. Great way to learn. Learn on B-grade movies.
Thomas, you assisted for Eddie Hamilton and for Lee. Both. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the progression from assistant up through additional editor or whatever, associate editor, and getting that spot? I know this isn't your first editing job. You've had several, but talk to me about that climb.
I was an assistant for 17 years. I went to the National Film and Television School after my second movie, after I was a second assistant on a film that was shot and cut on film that Jerry Hambling did, which was a great experience. I went to film school because I couldn't get on Avid. The film that was cut on Avid and film, the first assistant wouldn't let me near it. He was not the nicest guy and goaded me into applying to the National Film School, saying, oh, if you want to learn how to be an editor. So I did it, learning everything I could. I could have come out and cut TV. There were jobs like offered straight out of film school for it. But I went back to features as a trainee again, even though I'd been a second because it was the first job that I could find. Suddenly knowing so much about Avid, knowing how to cut. And then I kind of quickly went up to a first assistant within a couple of years, basically let everybody I was working with know that I was interested in the storytelling and interested in the creative side. I had to get very good at all the other stuff just so I could keep getting hired and build a reputation up. But I just sort of took my time making relationships and basically spending every single day talking about how to make the story and the movie work the best way it can and learning for myself. In every film that I worked on, there was a version of the cut that usually wasn't the end version that worked the best, and I had to try and work out why was this better. I'm very confident that he had this works the best because of this and this, and you know, I kind of gave my own additional film education by working on big budget movies with all the talented people who are on them and discussing it the whole time. And I was very lucky to get given lots of stuff to cut. I always did the sound on every film. You, in your previous question, you were talking about like working with sound. I was almost always thrown a rough sequence, just a production track sequence, and was told to track play it. Sometimes with like no time at all before people were coming in to watch it. It just really helps you learn how to make something instantly work and feel like a proper scene, feel like a movie. But the way I eventually got my break was I was on Star Wars Rogue One. I got told about a low budget film. The same company who made Gareth Edwards' first film, Monsters, were the production company on that film. It had a very low budget. It stars Natalie Dormer. It had quite a lot going on for it. But all the HODs were on a flat, very low flat rate, much less than I was my assistant rate. I spoke to Gareth about it and he goes, yeah, I know those guys who are producing that. If you want to do it, I'll write you a recommendation, which he did. And then I left just before I had to go to San Francisco on Rogue One at the end. And then I didn't assist again from that point.
What are some of the things that you learned as an assistant that you didn't learn in film school, you know, that struck you as a revelation?
Working in big budget, broad entertainment feature films, it's a very specific discipline of having to be able to tell a story in a short amount of time where you have to establish your characters very quickly. You have to keep the excitement and entertainment level up at a certain level all the way. They can't drop because the notes are always the same on almost every film that you ever work on. You get to the reel one and two, you're told are too long. The introducing the characters, the movie setup is always, you've got to get through this, this is boring. We joked on Tomb Raider, which was sort of the first big film that I cut, that you had to get to the island quicker. And then I heard someone talking about it on a film that didn't have an island, that there was a literal island in that film. And it's the same in every film that you work on. There's always a point where everybody says, well, you need to meet this character much sooner. How long does it take before this person comes in? Or how long does it take till we get to this set piece? I think the thing that you have in feature films is that you have to keep the nucleus of the character set up and the story set up interesting, makes you invest in it before you get on with the movie and the plot. Because the plot is usually the least interesting thing about a film, in my opinion, particularly these big budget films. They're a framework of which to hang set pieces and funny characters and charisma on top of. Very often there's a version of a film where you speed it up so much at the beginning that you just don't care about anybody anymore. That is a tipping point that you can quite quickly get to that point if you worked on a lot of films and say, look, I know you're going to want to get rid of this scene, but this is the scene where you connect with the character. And if you cut this down too much, we may be bored of it after 800 times of watching it, but an audience member watching it for the first time needs this in order to understand who our protagonist is. That's the sort of thing I learned working on all these big budget films that I don't think you could ever learn on a film school. Just being around the evolution of a feature film from a long first assembly to the final product, it has so many forms and versions. You so easily can go too far cutting the heart out of a story.
What about this film? What was the moment you were trying to get to?
Oh, it was meeting Aiden on the train. Well, there's two points. It's meeting Sam Rockwell and then the action sequence, which follows straight afterwards, the train sequence. That's the template of what the film really is, because the film pulls the rug on you and kind of wrong-foots you all the way through, as you know. But at the beginning of the film, particularly, you're not sure what kind of a movie that you're watching for quite a long time until the moment where that action sequence on the train starts. That is kind of the paradigm of what the movie is. Two different worlds are going to overlap. It's going to be action. It's comedy sewn into it. It's character beats. And before that, you're only getting one thing that isn't the whole picture.
Lee, can you talk about that scene, that specifically the intercutting of the two different heroes flashing back and forth? How did you choose those moments, or were those tightly scripted when you were cutting between the two of them?
Again, that was one of those ones where when I was putting it together, it was doing it without any stunt viz. So I was just responding. The joy of that scene was that it was shot with both the lead characters, or the three leads, were basically stepping into each other's roles between Henry and Sam. And the stunt material was shot fairly quickly afterwards. So what was great with that particular scene is you had it all in camera. So the choices of where to cut over were kind of sometimes dictated, but mainly just, I would just cut it for the lines. Like you were cutting a scene, and then I decide that this is where we'll flip to Henry for two words, then we'll flip back to Aiden, then we'll flip to Bryce, you know, blinking. It could have been done a million different ways, in other words. There was no reason or rhyme. It was just fun. I was just enjoying it. I'd never worked on a film with that style before of editing, you know, where you had sort of down the barrel coverage of Henry Cavill as if it's, you know, she's seeing him, and then there's the little blink visual effect that we were all laughing at Matthew, because I cut it without any visual effects of the blink, and I thought it worked really well. And Matthew kept saying, no, there has to be a blink visual effect. And, you know, we saw some early iterations, and thankfully it's quite tasteful in the final product, because the early iterations were kind of weird. But it was a lot of fun. That's all I can say, is that, again, that whole scene was just cut for fun. You just wanted to go on this ride with this crazy bearded man, and this is where we had to set up just the whole dynamic, and it came together pretty swiftly, and everything sort of just seemed to work on that scene. And it wasn't so heavily reliant on visual effects. You know, there was only, I think, one external train shot where the camera goes outside of the train and comes back in. The rest of it, of course, is just blue screen movement in the background and some fabulous stunt work to put in there. It was good. And that was shot really early. I can't remember. That was almost like the first sequence, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the first sequence. And the main unit moved on to something else, but left Henry and Sam with the second unit. So we had almost 2 weeks of the train, and it was done. And main unit started shooting some other stuff with Bryce concurrently towards the end.
Yeah.
It was good, as Lee said, because it all came together very well. And Matthew came and saw it and was immediately like, yep, this is the tone of my movie. This is the touchstone. We need to kind of look back at this and make sure that everything has the same level of comedy, the zany action, the character beats. He never changed it. Lee's first cut, apart from a few like tiny bookendy things, didn't change all the way through to the end, through the whole of post. There's always, I think, a scene in a movie that kind of nails it. Tone is so important in this film, and that one kind of was definitely the kind of touchstone for the tone. We were like, okay, this is what this movie is going to work. Matthew was like, yep, this is all going to work. That's what was in my head. Our assistants actually helped us find the piece of music, and then Lee cut it. That it stayed in from the first cut all the way to the end. We licensed it. We tried millions of other things, but we never got close to it. That was very fortuitous. All we were told is it needed to be a funky disco kind of vibe for this. That's where it just instantly stuck, like you say, like super glue.
And music on this film, temp music, was fascinating, because some of these sequences, my goodness, we amongst ourselves came up with everything for the first cut. And then past that point, when I came back after doing another film, Tom, through Matthew, had probably tried about 40 or 50 iterations, different kinds of music, and it was an ongoing thing, that's for sure. A lot of experimentation.
Music was definitely a big thing for Matthew in this. He wanted to sort of not just fall back on the tropes that he's done before, and he specifically said, I don't want it to be masculine-y kind of rock stuff, that we've got a female lead character. Sam Rockwell is always dancing. He instantly said disco is the right thing to go for here. So there's only so much disco-sourced music that you can use.
Surprisingly little. I think we heard every 80s disco track known to man.
I think we used the only one that had a high enough BPM to be exciting, because usually they have a good, they're good start and then they level out, so with no gear changes at all. So the one the Sylvester track we used was eminently cuttable, had loads of gear changes, yeah, and it also was quite good at feathering in bits of score into it as well.
I didn't realize there was score feathered in there.
It doesn't have score in that sequence, but we used score based on that song. We did a whole bunch of stuff where the Argyle themes were played in a disco thing using the beat, the cowbells from that track, which came and went from the film.
I was surprised because I'd seen the trailer, and of course there's no Henry in the trailer. Was there a trick to choosing that first moment where you're kind of flashing to that?
His appearance was in the script and choreographed. We pan away and we come back again. We pan away when he says all the other people in this car are spies. We're in her POV and we pan away and come back, and he's turned into Argyle, into Henry.
That was a very sort of scheduled moment for Henry's arrival.
The thing that you're maybe talking about is then he's talking at her while she's freaking out, explaining that it's all going to go bad and that everyone's going to attack them, and flicking between the two of them there. It's an interesting one because you had to be able to follow what they're saying to a certain extent, but also play it for the insanity of the moment and very much from her experience. You didn't want to cut too much on every line. You didn't want to cut the words up too much because you wanted to be able to follow it and also land the important parts. It was very funny. And again, that first cut was the points that Lee chose that stayed all the way through.
You mentioned early on that Matthew was very happy with that first cut and you were able to do some experimentation because of that. What were some of those things that were experimented with?
Two things that we spent absolutely ages on were probably the two most exposition-heavy sequences. The one in the log cabin where Aiden is telling Ellie what's happening. She wakes up and it's the first kind of reveal of what you thought was reality isn't, and introducing the bad guys. And then the actual introduction of Bryan Cranston's character, Rissa, they were two separate scenes completely. The scene with Sam Rockwell explaining to her, it was a good scene, but it was quite a long piece of dialogue, and then it's followed by another dialogue scene. To try and make the parallels between what she's written in her book and the real bad guy, Matthew said, this scene, I didn't design it like this, but I think this needs to be intercut. We tried so many different ways to intercut that, using the CCTV security footage that's revealed to be on the screen, that's been spying on her life, going through that screen to get, because he's looking at the same thing in the Bryan Cranston scene, and then cutting between them. We did that for a long time. And then the other scene, which was probably even more elaborate, was when Aiden's telling Ellie in the vineyard, when she says, tell me everything, and then you have to have a lot of backstory filled in there. That changed a lot. The order of which things were being revealed and all the many layers of exposition to try and keep it interesting, but so you didn't feel like this is just a long dialogue scene, to feather in flashbacks and visualizations of what he's talking about. And that was a big thing. I mean, we experimented with different things because the visual effects were taking so long, like different cuts of some of the more visual effects action sequences. Almost all of them were to kind of make sure that what we had was the best version. Like I said, Matthew likes to put a cut together that he's happy with for the visual effects sequences and then turn it all over and say, I'm not going to change it until I can see what this is. And which I, you know, is unusual, because usually you have a studio head of VFX sort of saying, no, the shot count has to be exactly what the shot count is. We're not going to have 400 shots of this sequence. If you're going to cut 100 of them out, do it now. But because Matthew's paying for it himself, he's not beholden to that. He thinks, this is kind of what I want it to be, but maybe it's too long until I can see what it actually is actually going to look like and feel like. I'm not going to cut anything out. I want you to get it up to a certain point before I do that. Everyone was saying, aren't we going to cut this down? We've cut everything else down. And he's like, no, I'm waiting for my versions yet before I do that. When you're waiting for visual effects for a long time, you end up tinkering with a lot of other stuff.
Is there an amount of management that goes into it that's be above and beyond the timeline, or is someone else managing that, or do you have to have a special assistant that's managing all that additional stuff, collaboration between departments, that kind of thing?
Most of the films I work on don't have that extended, protracted timeline that was involved in Argyle, because we're just working to studio release deadlines. So, you know, Argyle was an anomaly where we got to the first cut and then I left thinking that, you know, by the time I finish the other film, I'd be coming back to supervise or watch the mix. And of course, when I came back, it had virtually not moved forward from a visual effects standpoint, with the exception of obviously some tries and some fails and work in progress. And it was a surprise that it took that long. But from a management layer, I don't think it's dissimilar to, you know, what you're doing. If you were on a film that had 6 months in post, you know, it would be laid out in front of you as to, you've got this long to get the cut, you're going to do this many test screenings, you've got this long to make audience adjustments, and then you've got this long to mix. So when you have a kind of an open-ended end, there is no schedule. It's just goes off into the horizon. That, in fact, does tend to make it kind of an unwieldy beast, because I think the entire post schedule on Argyle was just simply dictated by visual effects.
Your question about whether big films like needed a different kind of way of approaching like the managing or the running of the cutting room. This film was actually really different from all the other studio films that I've worked on, because this film has the director is also the producer, who's also the financier of his own film. And so there isn't a studio. There isn't that kind of pyramid level of kind of people being worried about someone looking over their shoulder, or it was Matthew and then he has his producers and people who work with him regularly. So it had a kind of, probably from that side of things, a smaller feel, because we didn't have a studio looking over our shoulders. There was no, you have 10 weeks to do your director's cut and then you have to show it to the producers. The producers are all your longtime collaborators and he's the main producer. So there's no politics in this, where most of these big films, is the big difference, I think, between smaller films and big budget films is when there's more money, there's lots more politics. There's lots more people buzzing around. There's more producers, more studio executives, and the pressure that comes with kind of keeping all those people happy, keeping them all involved. We didn't have any of that with this film, even though it's a big budget, big movie. That is definitely a thing that is a different vibe from working on small films. And in terms of you saying, do you need a special assistant? There is very often the first assistant editor on a big feature film is sometimes someone who has to be a little bit more like a first assistant director in the way that they have to kind of like say, no, we're not turning this down over to this. We're not doing this. They have to protect the editor a bit and the director and try and dictate when things get released, when people are baying for new turnovers and things. You have to be strong and confident enough to keep everybody back and communicate with the director and the editor. It wasn't the case on this film, because like I say, it was his rhythms that we had to follow. On big budget films, there are a lot of people involved in the post process and they all want to be up to speed all the time. And that's obviously not possible. If you're in the middle of a recut of something, it's pointless for people to react to it when it's not a new line in the sand, or it's not a new version. Keeping everybody happy, keeping people at arm's length when they need to be kept at arm's length is a thing that very much more specific to big budget films.
And falls to the assistant, falls to the first assistant.
Well, it depends. There's some editors who like to be really involved in the politics and the running of things, and some, many more, who don't want to have to deal with that stuff. The first assistant's job is to kind of protect the editor and the director and let them get on with cutting the film, and also to look 3 or 4 turns down the road at what's coming up and preempt it, so it doesn't, no one's going to get caught out. I've worked with some editors when I was an assistant who wanted to be involved in some stuff, and most of them who just said, like, if you need me to put my shoulder behind something, tell me, but if not, you just get on with it and tell me the things I need to know.
Lee, other than this opening train sequence that we talked about, was there a scene that was either very difficult and challenging or that you just loved cutting that you could talk about?
I think the train was the most fun for me because visually it was the most complete for my time on the film. As in fun, like realizing that this style of action can work. I think the Hyde Park scene, Tom did a really good version of the Hyde Park that was intercutting with everyone. I did a good version, and then I looked at Tom's, and then I took some of Tom's stuff and incorporated it. And that was a very, I think for both of us, a great collaborative moment where, you know, we realized we're both very much on the same page. But with this style of overlapping editing where people are finishing the last statement and everything, I hadn't done any of that before. And I did find that a lot of fun and enjoyable, and knew that could work. And I saw a screening of it here in Santa Barbara for the first time, which was a shock to me because I'm seeing completed sequences that I'd never seen. And a mix that I'd never heard. So there was a lot going on in my head and changes that I didn't know had happened. Those were going on in my head. But there was a lot of good, hard editorial work. That scene in the vineyard that Tom was talking about that was recut, cut, recut, 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 cut, reorganized. And it was reorganized differently to how I did it for this final screening. The first scene between Ellie and Aiden, when Aiden was explaining to her that she used to be CIA, blah, 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 Tom and I were talking about, we both watched the dailies and it ran for like 12 minutes. I'm looking at it going, this is not possible. It's like I would be a basket case. So I made it my mission, and my bold statement was that by the time I'm finished with it, I'm hoping it will be half that on my first pass. Now, you don't normally make sweeping statements because, you know, if your master's running 12 minutes, it's tricky to get it down. So there were those scenes that were just super challenging that you just looked at them and I went, two characters sat for that amount of time, we're screwed. We've got to work out how to do that. And there was some material to intercut, but not a lot. We got a reasonable pass, and I think in the end result, it was reordered. They're the really heavy lifting scenes where they seem, I'm sure for most people watching them, they're the least likely scene you'd ever imagine took any time. And yet there was an amazing amount of time afforded to that sequence. Sam Rockwell, God love him, he is different in every take. So you also got trapped with different takes, different things that were happening. I mean, he's an amazing actor.
What about you, Tom? A big, either a challenging scene or a scene that you loved working on?
Lee's reminded me of scenes that were so much longer that we had to work different ways out of them. I mean, the most fun, apart from the train, was really good fun, but the scene where they go in and into the apartment and the guy bursts out of the floor, that was, I thought, a really fun action scene. And the whole stuff when they raid the building, Sam Rockwell's ad-libbing a lot, and I think we mined a lot of good things out of that. And it was kind of planned, and there was nothing really to fix. It was just quite a lot of cutting down and making stuff tighter. There's scenes where the ones that work a little bit less well or obviously way too long and you have to find a solution for are probably the most satisfying things, I think. At the end of the day, when you kind of go, well, I cracked that. The day that Matthew said this scene where you introduced Ritter was like finally working was an amazing relief to me, because we had tried it in so many different ways and like come up with new characters that weren't even in the film. All the people in the bad guys in the fictional world have a counterpart in the real world, and we realized one of the bad guys doesn't have a counterpart in the book. We even went to the extent of inventing another character to see whether that would help kind of clarify the fictional world is the same as her real world, where everyone has a counterpart. The scene that I really love, the bit of the scene, is the head's crushing scene, because it's where Matthew's pushing it a bit on whether this is going to be acceptable to an audience, that they're talking about crushing skulls and comparing it to watermelons and cracking an egg. And I thought Sam Rockwell was like, he was nailing it on that one and just giving us good ad-libs all the way through it. The one that Lee just talked about in Hyde Park, in the script, the fictional heroes and the real heroes will all be trying to solve the same problem when we all intercut here. Matthew at one point said, maybe we'll do this in split screens, which Lee responded to with saying, if we're doing that, Tom, you're doing all of that, the split screen stuff. I'm not going near it, which I think was a callback to X-Men First Class, where there is split screen stuff in that, but that's a 1960s aesthetic where split screens kind of made sense. And I think Lee asked Eddie to do a lot of that stuff because he's not a fan of split screens, and I'm not a fan of split screens. And I was like, I'm going to try and make this so we don't have to have split screens. and to make the intercut as bouncy, and it's dry exposition really. They're trying to search, go through firewalls and things like that. You need to cut that in a way where that is not the point of it. The exposition and the information you're getting is in it, but that's not the point of the scene. And the point of the scene is that all of the worlds are kind of intersecting with each other, and we're having character beats and we're having fun with it. If the fun drops too much in a movie like this, you know, you'll start to lose the audience. We both did a version of this intercut, and it was a very symbiotic experience because we were like, oh wow, yeah, that was a really good idea. And Matthew was absolutely delighted with it, and we didn't have to do any split screen.
That shows your success right there.
Yes, exactly. He never mentioned split screens again, so that was a big win.
And Lee, the idea of having this long dialogue scene that you, on the first cut, right, almost cut in half or down to 5 minutes, that's pretty unusual, but I can understand why. And it's so interesting that you said it's a scene that you wouldn't have thought was that difficult, which makes you think all these awards for editing, you're like, you'd look at that scene and go, oh, that's an easy scene to cut, but it's not.
That's the thing with editing awards, is only the editors know the complexity of what they've done. I know films that I've cut that were just acutely complicated, and they don't get any interest at awards. That's the nature of the beast. There's sequences that go through in movies that I always get asked about, and they go, that was amazing, how did you do it, man? And I'm going, that was easy, that didn't take any time, that was a joy. What you're missing is the other scene that was a fucking nightmare, and we were pulling our hair out, and it was all shot wrong, and they were undercovered, and oh, blah blah blah. The other scene that I forgot that I really, really enjoyed was when Bryan Cranston reveals himself in the Savoy. Again, that was three great actors in a room. It was just joy to edit that sequence. And again, it's a seemingly simple sequence, but it was just intensely enjoyable. They were all good in that scene, and that was a lot of fun.
Tom, Lee, thank you so much for joining us on Art of the Cut. It was so enjoyable talking about this movie. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And thank you, Tom.
Thank you. It was great.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Lee Smith, ACE, and Tom Harrison Reed for joining us on Art of the Cut to discuss Argyle. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Holfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you want a good follow on socials, I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @SteveHolfish. I'm always posting helpful editing gems that will hopefully give you a good for the day. See you out there.